Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for arriving.
Thank you for
coming. I was going to give a long talk today on the evolution of the I, you know, playing on words a little bit, following the pun instead of any rational thought. I'm better at puns than I am rational thought. But I decided not to do that. The subject was too big, and I kept putting it off, collecting books, but not reading them. So I had a big pile of books, and it was last night. So I'm going to talk about storytelling instead. Actually, Giroux put up he said, "Oh, you need a topic? I have a topic for you." And he brought out a calligraphy for the month of December. Beautiful. You could see it up in the small dining room. It said, "Relinquish," which is kind of a nice word for December when we're shopping or maybe just thinking that I still want that electric train that I wanted in fourth grade. But I think, since I was in high school and was reading Alan Watts and thinking, these Buddhists who are writing books, they don't have the backbone to really relinquish what they need to relinquish. They need, you know, this quest outside the scriptures, where words, putting anything in words, is a defilement, and they manage to still generate 80,000 sutras. I love that, and I think it might be fundamentally that that's how we incorporate. That's how we get the inside out. That's how we overcome separateness. And basically, we don't have a lot of choice because we've evolved for, if you count right back to the beginning, I suppose, 14, 15 billion years, where we've been built to do this. We've been hardwired to make stories up about stuff. We have five senses all that we put into play, and we have fun, and they make us miserable. But it's basically, as David Loy said in the title of his book, the world is made of stories. And maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Maybe there's a hard physical material world out there. I mean, it makes sense that there would be, right? Because there was a lot of time, most of time, when there was no storyteller to arrange things. But as far as we're concerned, we can't really make sense of things without making up a story, or just the fact that we see things with bounced off photons influences how we see things and the stories we tell. And if we were bats, we'd have different stories, I have a feeling. They'd be more sonorous. So, I brought this book that I recommend highly, The World is Made of Stories. But what I was saying about Buddhists was that most of us don't want to relinquish words. We don't want to relinquish stories. We don't want to just sit with our senses deprived. We like popcorn. We like movies. We like just walking and sensing things. And we like, the Tibetans approve, they've shown that we like bright colors sometimes. And it's a sensuous world, and we're built to respond. And we're also hardwired to tell our stories. And it's been suggested that Zen is a way of, and Zen koans and Zen stories are a way of using stories to free us from stories. And that's paradoxical, right? And Zen is paradoxical, so it fits right in. What I was really want to talk about today is not relinquishing so much as intimacy and the relationship, maybe, to relinquishing. My thesis here is that the more you relinquish, the more intimate you become. And it ties in with a lot of things like austerity and simplicity and sitting quietly alone in a room. And I think Pascal said, all evil comes from the inability of people to sit alone in a room. And you can chew on that, put that in your pipe and smoke it. See. A few quotes to avoid any egotistical self-promotion. I'll just read to you what other people have written, okay? The universe is made of stories, not atoms. Muriel Rukeyser. The story is an account of something. What's the story on these unpaid bills? If the world is made of stories, stories are not just stories. They teach us what is real, what is valuable, and what is possible. Without stories, there's no way to engage with the world because there is no world, and no one to engage with it because there is no self. The world is made of our accounts of it because we never grasp the world as it is in itself, apart from stories about it. We do not experience the world and then make up stories to understand it. Whenever we try to peel them all away to discover the reality behind, whatever becomes exposed immediately transforms into story, like excavated artifacts that disintegrate as soon as uncovered. The same is true of ourselves, but that is getting ahead of the story. This is not to deny or assert that there is a world apart from our stories, only that we cannot understand anything without storing it. To understand is to story. Wittgenstein said, "The limits of my language are the limits of my world, and the limits of my stories are the limits of my world." We want to discover the master story, the one true meta-story that includes and explains all other stories, but it's turtles all the way up too. And that goes back to that story that I'm sure you've heard somewhere by now, that this Hindu priest was talking and somebody asked him, well, what holds up the world? And he said, an elephant, a giant elephant. And he said, but what holds up the elephant? And he said, a turtle. A giant turtle. And then he said, but what holds up the giant turtle? And he said, oh, from then on down, it's all turtles. That gives me great comfort. I don't know why. The biggest meta stories are mostly religious. God, Brahman, and Tao. Such stories try to point at something that transcends stories, yet a meta story cannot get outside itself to explain the relationship between stories and that which is outside stories. A Zen metaphor warns us not to take the finger pointing at the moon for the moon itself, but the moon itself is also not the moon. And then that page ends with, no Dharma has ever been taught by a Buddha to anyone, anywhere. Not a Arjuna. So, with that in mind, that you're not going to learn anything from me here, I'm going to read a story. And I'm pleased to say that it has an illustration, which I'll pass around. This is, you'll find out what this is. It should be in color. It should start out bright on the right and fade to the left, I think. This is called a true story based on fiction. It's like those country western singles, a true story, and then in parentheses, based on fiction. Like the country western record I remember well, Let's Get Drunk, parentheses, and screw. Never mind. Molly's last clear words, "What time is it?" I looked over the edge of the bed when she asked the question. She was checking a mouse trap, a clear plastic live trap she had set with a bit of chocolate the night before. She thought she heard something, a rustling. She pulled aside the batik fabric fastened with red and green pushkin pins, and crouching, moved a few of the Tupperware cartons out into the room. The last I saw of Molly was her naked bottom, a splendid half-orb, so recently warmly fondled. Molly and I were, I believed, much in love. And at this point, I'm considering a change in title. I've never really liked that title, although it makes discursive sense. So if you come up with an alternate title, you can have a... their prizes. Molly disappeared at 7 in the morning on June 16th. She crawled into the storage space beneath her plywood sleeping platform, a large space where she stacked most of her possessions in tightly lidded plastic boxes. She muttered something, I think it was, fuck, and then the fabric fell into place, like a curtain, over her life, her very existence. Molly just vanished. We woke early that morning, about 5 a.m., and she made English breakfast tea, which she served with honey and soy milk. Propped up with pillows and covered with a comforter, we drank the tea in her bed. I convinced her, with a slow massage of her shoulders and a persistence of kisses, to make love. She was not a morning person in this respect. Sex was absolutely unthinkable before at least a cup of strong tea. Her favorite time was 3 or 4 in the afternoon, once a week, maybe less. She also favored certain times of the month, which I was honored to have come to know. In any case, it was a long, cajoling, slowly satisfying morning right up until she disappeared. Molly, I asked from above, waiting for her to emerge. Molly, come up. The remodeled goat barn is very small, and her absence was immediately felt. Something alive and warm had evaporated. You okay? No answer. I pushed aside the comforter and dropped myself from the platform to the floor, pulling back the fabric, decorated with some strange Gauguin print. Golden women, their breasts bare, seated around a pale blue statue, also of a woman, and peered into the still dark space in the footprint of a queen-size mattress, but 4 feet high and filled with translucent boxes. The mouse trap was empty of mice, but the chocolate mysteriously gone, and no Molly. It was obviously some kind of prank, out of character for Molly, but what did I know? She sometimes showed a bit of girlish mischief, and we didn't really know each other very well. Most often, actually, Molly was sincere and earnest, almost saintly in her concerns and not given to practical jokes, puns, or even, she made clear to me, sarcasm or irony. The first she associated with verbal violence in her ex-boyfriend, the second with subtle deceit. I try to say what I mean and mean what I say, she said early in our relationship, during a barefoot walk on the beach, holding hands, finding out about each other. An elephant's faithful 100%, I mumbled, quoting from Horton Hatch's The Egg, the very first book I remember reading, or having read to me, actually, memorizing it so that people would think that I could read. What? I meant what I said, and I said what I meant. An elephant's faithful 100%, Dr. Seuss. The green eggs and ham guy. Come on out, I said now, although I saw no potential hiding place. I imagined her impossibly scrunched somewhere like a magician's assistant. Ollie, oxen free, I added, which is what we used to say as kids playing hide and seek, although it never made sense exactly, and was supposed to be, Ollie, all come free, I imagined later. Allie. Now I was a little concerned, but at the same time beginning to feel irritated and impatient with this foolishness. Her dog, excited that I was moving boxes out of their places, barked a piercing, high decibel chirp, which did not subside as I slid stacks of crates from beneath the bed. The dog and an aging Australian shepherd no doubt sensed that something was amiss with her flock. I cleared the space entirely just to find the exit, a loose plank, a trap door, but couldn't detect even the smallest chink in the plywood siding or the flooring. In fact, I didn't see how mice found their way into this tiny shelter. the space. This space, the size of a lower bunk, was tight and to all appearance secure. But Molly was not in it, and there was no way she could have gotten out of it. I considered some sort of sliding panel carefully fitted into the rest of the woodwork like a small jewelry box. I pressed and pushed on several boards in the plywood sheets. Nothing budged. Molly, I said loudly, firmly. Molly once complained that a certain tone of voice of mine was childlike, ingratiating, shrill, and ultimately unmanly. She had no use for me when I looked for mothering, when I looked for her for approval. I could see the interest pass from her eyes and mouth like blood fading from her cheeks. Come out! Come on out! Deep-voiced imperative. I backed out of the space on my hands and knees, toppling a stack of well-packed and neatly labeled containers. I fastened on my yellow dressing gown and stood a moment against the dizziness, taking stock. Molly was, in fact, an advertising representative for a container manufacturing company. She had a way with containers. And without her organizational skills, the place would never have accommodated the two of us, not even for the occasional overnight. But her corporate clients would never have guessed their rep's secret life. Molly insisted on living efficiently, ethically, simply, and, to use her words, spiritually. She had no running hot water or refrigerator. She heated water on a hot plate, bathed with a washcloth dipped in a pot of heated water, and used a composting toilet. She depended on friends for showers, which is how we first got to know each other. My shower was conveniently located in the studio apartment adjacent to her pottery workshop. Ceramics had become a hobby for her after a brief stint as a professional potter, her shoulders and hands too fragile for the sustained effort of production. Along the wall above the bed, her previous boyfriend had built a shelf which ran half the length of the wall and which she used as an altar, supporting a statue of Buddha, a picture of an Indian saint, another of Christ staring out with large limpid eyes, and a bowl arched over with spent incense. She had a knack for getting boyfriends to build things for her, and generally, it seemed, not being satisfied with the results. The altar, for example, was not deep enough, she said. I had only recently begun to realize how this inclination to judgment might focus on me. Her engagement ring was too prongy. The kitchen shelves I put up, obviously crooked. The dress I bought her, not the pure cotton she thought environmentally sound. The vegetables I made for dinner, not organic. You are the most opinionated and judgmental woman I have ever met, I said to her once, teasing. That sounds like a judgment, she said, but we laughed. Her therapist, a man named Walter, whom she saw only on rare occasion in spiritual emergencies, said I was a wise man to be able to joke about such things. I encouraged her to see more of this healer. She must have slipped outside somehow without me noticing. I walked out to the newly installed composting toilet, its fan humming quietly, but the door swung wide open on the stall, revealing no evidence of Molly. I shuffled down a path through the nettles around the edge of the goat barn and through blackberry brambles and lush foliage along the back of the structure. I looked up the slope into the shadow under the barn, into the bare incline of dark dirt beneath the flooring. No footprints, no place to hide, and no Molly. I felt an odd combination of panic and resentment. Not really knowing what was going on, and so not knowing how to respond, I jogged down the narrow path she had so recently weed-whacked through nettles, sheep's ears, blackberry, and poison oak to the main house, where she stood perishables in her, where she stored perishables in her landlady's refrigerator. "Molly here?" I asked the landlady, who, even at 80, maintained a strict schedule of feeding the animals at 7, then breakfasting over the morning paper. She looked over her glasses, spoon of granola in her hand. She was comfortable in her comfortable kitchen. "Don't see much of Molly these days. I think you've distracted her, young man. I'm surprised that you lose track of her, however." I am not a young man, but in fact, Molly worried that my arrival and occasional overnight stays had alienated her landlady's affections. She told me, "I used to play Scrabble with her once a week. I used to go to family dinner on Thursday. Since I met you, I don't do that." I didn't suggest that this was her choice. Molly had a way of blaming me. I was a bad influence. I never enjoyed Scrabble. "She's kind of disappeared," I explained to the landlady. "Well, you better find her," she said, jokingly, I think, but she had a straight-faced humor, timing perfected over decades. "People don't just disappear, not these days." I don't think the landlady liked me much, perhaps for monopolizing Molly's attention, perhaps just because I was a perturbation, a minor disturbance in her homespun universe, which she felt like a spider in the center of a web. In any case, just sharing Molly's absence with another person who responded lightheartedly, almost glibly, returned me to reality, to the world firm in space and time, the world from which a beautiful, lithe, betrothed woman does not simply vanish. Betrothed. I love that old-fashioned word. To be in truth. My betrothed. However, a half hour more of increasingly panicky searching didn't yield a single trace or clue, a single handhold on the sheer improbability. I was at a complete loss, and my loss was complete. Should I just wait? Could I just wait? How long? I felt the muscles over my collarbone slowly tightening, my abdomen cringing, pulling in on itself as if I were spontaneously losing weight and girth. I shook once or twice with a full-body tremor. A strange, feathery energy pulsed through me. What immediately suggested itself was the magic closet of C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia, the lion, the witch, and the wardrobe. But that was a fantasy, a children's book, and no one, even the 70% of Americans who purportedly believe in angels, could seriously believe that a person simply disappeared into the space beneath the plywood sleeping platform. The first few hours amounted to a befuddled response. Could I call 911? When? Maybe after a few more hours? Was this an emergency? Should I file a missing person report? Was Molly really missing? Yes, but didn't the quality of missing depend on duration somehow? An accumulation of absence? Was she really gone? How? Where? And maybe why? The dog left off her concerned yip, but continued to whine sporadically as I lapsed into a sprawl on Molly's old blue couch, staring into the space where she had disappeared. Finally, I lowered the fabric, hoping perhaps for a miraculous reappearance. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. I stared into the boutique, and the longer I stared, the stranger it seemed. It was a panorama of life, beginning on the right with an infant, ending on the left with a naked old woman. A goat, a dog, two cats, and a peacock pursued their business. Also from right to left, the colors seemed to fade from yellow and blue and orange to darker, sootier, starker contrast of black and white. There were 12 human figures in the canvas and one statue, a blue woman on an altar. The painting was titled in the upper left-hand corner, "D'où venons-nous? Que sommes-nous? Où allons-nous?" It seemed an odd, overlong title for a painting. Who writes the name of his painting on the canvas itself anyway? Yet it beckoned to me, welcomed me strangely. There seemed to be a lot of contemplation in the painting. Even the dog and goat appeared to be sitting in thought. Where do we come from? What are we? Where are we going? I knew just enough French to translate. Why had Molly chosen this fabric? Or was it something left over, like the awful blue vinyl couch where I sat, which somehow, I think, in its kitschiness and absolute lack of value, contributed to merit points, to saintliness. The total lack of concern for material wealth, the disdain for aesthetic discrimination, for duality. The painting itself seemed clumsy and crude, primitive, although mysterious. Molly liked Gauguin. Was this disappearance some sort of ascension? Molly had a quality of which she was aware, even if she didn't actually articulate it often, of saintliness, of purity, of striving for a higher, holier state, one involving more compassion, gratitude, appreciation, selflessness, service, and actual prayer. When I first met Molly, I never actually said a prayer and had no notion of who or what such a genre would assume as audience. In contrast, she had done a number of vision quests, several days spent in the wilderness without food or water. She had committed to 4 of these and still had 1 more to do. They seemed to give her a core strength. She had also spent weeks in Zen monasteries as a guest student. She still tried to sit early every morning, and it was her frailty when it came to this discipline that I loved most. I'm so sleepy, she would whine in a little girl's voice and then roll over and sleep for another hour or two. She sometimes hinted at more esoteric involvement. I imagine she was talking erotic tantric rites or maybe something involving controlled substances. I was impressed that she owned a copy of The Doors of Perception, as well as Terence McKenna's Food of the Gods, where we learned that humankind came to the sacred via psychedelic plant substances. I knew that somewhere she kept a journal. She was protective, if not secretive, when it came to this involvement. At times she was defensive and did not see the humor in me calling some of her friends woo-woo. For my part, I saw humor as a corollary of compassion, a distancing yet comforting modality. I think it was Suzuki Roshi, founder of San Francisco Zen Center, who said that Americans took things too seriously. When we slept and woke up together, which we did a couple of times a week, we sometimes moved to sitting position after our tea, lit a stick of incense, and sat in meditation right there in the bed in front of her little shelf of an altar. When we were done sitting, Molly would pray out loud to the Creator in the Native American tradition, a personal rambling style of address. What I'm getting at is that Molly had a streak, a rather deep if diffuse vein of spirituality, although religiosity is the word that came to mind first. And my question is, are such people snatched up by God occasionally, granted an audience? When I finally called the police after close to 3 unimaginably anguished hours, God was not a suspect. I was. It was noted that my record included 2, not 1, but 2 DUIs, which suggested to the investigating officer and later to the detective that I had a problem with alcohol. Did I have blackouts? Had I been drinking at the time of Molly's disappearance? Had we had any disagreements or arguments, particularly drunken arguments? I admitted freely to a problem in the past much more immediate even than the last 5-year-old DUI, which would suggest. But one of the conditions Molly imposed on a relationship early on was no drinking. She had heard stories about me around town. She scoffed at my suggestion after William James that sobriety diminishes, discriminates, and says no. Drunkenness expands, unites, and says yes. I gave up this approach to the radiant core. Although not by any means averse to non-ordinary states of consciousness, Molly dismissed my drinking as pathological and unacceptable. Dionysus excommunicated. After our first night together, I had embarked on a 5-day fast of nothing but concoctions of lemon juice, maple syrup, and a pinch of cayenne to clean out my system and detoxify my body. This was Molly's suggestion. She even had a pamphlet with a recipe and a discussion of the cleansing, purifying benefits. In those early days, I think I was a project for Molly, a mission. With my newfound clarity, I asked Molly, after less than a month of involvement, to marry me. I had bought an emerald ring with money from my inheritance, much like my mother's, and Molly, surprised, flattered, and impressed, said yes. She changed her mind shortly after, but those first few days of being engaged were exquisite. She kept the ring and was wearing it on her right hand when she vanished. There was the distinct possibility that, given time, Molly would say yes again. Did you resent this change of heart? The detective asked me. You mean, did she make me angry enough to do away with her? I asked back, incredulously. Maybe an emotional abyss opened before you with the prospect of losing her. Maybe you panicked. Maybe you were drunk. I stopped a drunk driver once who wanted me to believe he'd gotten a bad bunch of O'Doul's. You know, that non-alcoholic beer? I know what O'Doul's is, for Christ's sake. But you see what I mean? Criminals say the damnedest things. I was not arrested, but I was asked to be available for further questioning. I'm sure she'll turn up, the detective said, and I hung to those words and that confidence over the next few days. From Nicholas of Cusa in the 15th century, how needful it is for me to enter into the darkness and to admit the coincidence of opposites beyond all the grasp of reason, and there to seek the truth where impossibility meeteth me. Molly's disappearance, as it gelled in time, was the only thing I thought about, the only thing I could think about. This was different than a death, that natural subtraction from life. I still mourn the loss of my mother only a year before Molly vanished, but a death is a rational loss, the confirmation of our finite and natural existence. All machines wear out. There's no such thing as perpetual motion, and our grief and mourning don't exceed our mortal capabilities, although so much can be thrown into question. Death, even one as unreasonable as a child's, is part of a rational and predictable nexus of cause and effect. But Molly's disappearance had, for me at least, an irrational and unimaginable center, an element not to believe, but which had to be accepted, like the square root of -1, like black holes with their irreconcilable but ineluctable density and gravity, like the beginning or before the beginning of the universe, like the universe supporting 11 dimensions, as current superstring theory alleges, the majority of them coiled and unmanifested. When it came to Molly's vanishing, I could not think about it, but I could not stop. I was addicted to Molly, to loving Molly, and now to her loss. Her not being present challenged the very core of day-to-day life. And God, I missed her eyes, whether skeptical, amused, irritated, or looking up drowsily, that pale, pale blue from orgasm. I missed her long fingers, her thin lips, her legs draped over mine in the morning, the not-so-delicate fur of her unshaven legs and the golden tangle of her hair. Once a deadhead, her wild hair still drifted on the verge of dreadlocks and was a sore point with her mother. Her absence was not explicable, not rational. I couldn't get any sort of handle on it. It was a koan, my own personal, radically paradoxical lesson from the universe, designed to drive me to the essentials, to the realities we weren't equipped to understand intellectually, to the depths of the present. I can't eat. I can't sleep. I feel for Demeter missing Persephone, for Orpheus, his Eurydice, and Edgar Allan Poe, missing his Annabelle Lee, for the moon never beams without bringing my dreams of the beautiful Annabel Lee. The two myths, I doubt, had much currency for my Molly, though I read her the Poe verse once, trying to gently nudge her past her rather obstinately held position. I don't get poetry. What's the point? I quoted William Carlos Williams as well. It is difficult to get the news from poems, yet men die miserably every day for lack of what is found there. Is that some kind of poem, Molly asked? I mean, what makes that a poem? It doesn't even rhyme. I don't get it. I played Joan Baez singing Annabelle Lee, thinking it would be a gentle introduction. So much of appreciation is simple familiarity, and that poem certainly rhymes. Who calls Poe the Jingle Man? Doesn't anyone pursuing the spiritual need poetry? Doesn't poetry and its melding of sound, rhythm, and word oppose the mundane, the profane, the conceptual, with unrelenting mystery? I thought I would educate my darling to the joys of poetry with the owl and the pussycat, the jabberwocky, stopping by woods on a snowy evening, and sea fever. Poems I knew by heart from childhood and high school, poems Molly should care about simply because they were part of my internal rhythms. It is perhaps symptomatic of our relationship that she memorized a St. Francis prayer before she even read one of my suggestions, the prayer that accompanies the 11th step in AA and begins, Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. I think if we ever get married, I ventured once, we should read The Owl and the Pussycat at the wedding. Molly, if I remember, and I do remember, raised her eyebrows. Wouldn't that be sort of childish? It was at that moment, to be quite honest, that I began to wonder if we had a future together. She had a teenager's fear of being childish. A good critic, I think John Updike made this point, approaches a work with a view as to what the artist was attempting, a consideration of intent. In my non-stop deliberation on Molly's disappearance, I wondered if it may have been intentional on her part, a lesson in a long course of miracles, something she concocted just to shake my skepticism. Of all the poems I inflicted on Molly, only one vaguely poetic utterance by Samuel Taylor Coleridge appeared to have any impact. What if you slept? And what if in your sleep you dreamed? And what if in your dream you went to heaven and there plucked a strange and beautiful flower? And what if when you awoke you had the flower in your hand? She already knew the work from a self-help book, something about magic in our daily lives. The bounty of the imagination is all well and good and marvelous, but the treacherous backside of this give and take between the real and the imagined and the dreamed is that elements of the real world, Molly, for example, can dematerialize without notice, sucked up to heaven. One can only suppose that flowers vanish to this other dimension with as much frequency as they appear in ours. Thus, the wonderful world of the imagination takes on a sinister, predatory quality. Still, I wonder if Molly were not trying to instruct here. With her disappearance, Molly, deliciously alive and vibrant, whisks herself off to some paradise and waits in that irrational dimension for me to discover the power of prayer. It's up to me to embrace the illogical and the miraculous. On some journey into dreams, she forces me to assume humility, to accept a higher power. Molly's last reading had been a series of books, Reflections of the Christ Mind, and she presented me with another slim volume by the same self-anointed Jesus channeler, Creating a Spiritual Relationship. The book wound up on her bookshelf, and I took it out as I contemplated her recent spontaneous evaporation. In the second chapter, Living Alone, Molly has highlighted a single sentence: living alone is the best way to prepare to be in a relationship, or in relationship. In the third section, Relationship as Addiction, she has drawn a red arrow next to the following peal of self-help wisdom: when we feel empty inside, we usually look for something outside of ourselves to fill that emptiness. Sometimes the external stimulus is alcohol or a drug. Sometimes it is television, work, religion, sex, or falling in love. There are many ways to fill the emptiness, but none of them last. The way that you challenge that belief is to practice accepting yourself as you sit with emptiness. The kind of passage that only a few months ago would have had me sneering, how true, leaves me humbled now. The ball is in my court. It is not out of the question, then, that Molly had somehow engineered her own vanishing as a pedagogic tool for me, for getting me to do my homework. Perhaps to get Molly back, I will have to take Christ in some form or another into my heart. More correctly, in the New Age vernacular, I will have to learn to stand in loving relationship to myself. In a powerful act of self-redemption, acknowledge the Godhead already present in my deepest self. Self with a capital, self, the greater self. This sort of heuristic intervention on Molly's part may be the catalytic process my soul's chemistry demands. My life has been free of exigencies. I have never been pressed against the wall, never had to cry for help or mercy or even leniency. I had, I thought, no need of faith and could not bring myself to prayer. I would have felt silly, childish, as if I had given up independent rational thought, our highest calling, to be subsumed under some mindless acceptance, some establishment line. How ordinary and sheepish, a bumper sticker catharsis. Let go, let God. A midlife crisis averted, or at least diffused, with an embrace of the sacred. I would be playing golf next. But finally, Molly's disappearance is not of the ordinary. It is as if I'd woken up as a cockroach, no less unbelievable, no less horrendous. I have been incorporated into some story by Kafka. Quote, when it had already become unbearable, once toward evening, and I went pacing down the strip of carpet in my room as if on a racetrack, and then turned back in alarm at the sight of the brightly lit street to find a fresh goal at the opposite end of the room in the depths of the wall mirror, and I screamed out loud, only to hear the scream which meets with no answer, and which nothing can diminish in its power, so that it goes on rising without a counterbalance and can never ever stop after its sound is gone. Unquote. That was Kafka. On the third day, these days are so long, each moment an inhospitable expanse of impossibility and anguish. How do we get from one moment to the next, even at the best of times? What does it mean to get from one moment to the next? On the third day, I bought 3 books: Learn to Pray, A Practical Guide to Faith and Inspiration, The Art of Prayer, an Orthodox Anthology, and How to Build a Time Machine, a book by a theoretical physicist, covering my bases. I was set to learn to pray when an interview with John Updike distracted me. In talking about one of his own short stories, he quoted Yeats, who said, "A woman lost is more interesting than a woman not lost." Updike continued, "So around this ache, this story was constructed sentence by sentence, and I think that fiction in that time of my life served me as a kind of therapy, just putting things down and trying to make shapely paragraphs, assuaged my sense of a dislocated life and of a dreadful mistake having somehow occurred, quoted in Boulevard, number 51, page 28. Updike had struck me long ago as having concerned himself with the problem of God when it was actually no longer a problem for most people who read novels, not outside Pennsylvania anyway. And that, combined with his dedication to golf earned him a conservative aura in my pantheon of writers. Nevertheless, here he was constructing a short story just as I am constructing my narrative, one sentence at a time, with bricks of sorrow, using the story as therapy. Coincidentally, Molly grew up in Pennsylvania, but I am confident she has never heard of John Updike. Back to prayer. Inner spiritual training, I read in the Orthodox anthology, begins with these words of Christ. When thou prayest, enter into thy closet, and when thou hast shut the door, pray to thy Father, which is in secret. Matthew 6. Here's that notion of disappearing into a small and secret space, escaping through some portal to the divine, into the closet, under the bed. I always suspected, even feared, that there was a part of Molly deeply committed elsewhere, and that this part was in secret communion. She gained a certain strength in this. She did not need me as I needed her to fill some emptiness, some void. On the other hand, when for some reason her faith, her communion, her sense of divinity, whatever the hell it was, faltered, there was no way for me to help. She went so far as to accuse me of using sex to offset my addiction to alcohol. I accused her, in my own head, of being a cold fish, looking for excuses for her fear of intimacy. I was acclimating to the jargon. In a small notebook of Molly's, mostly filled with odd notes and recipes for food and glazes and daily lists of things to do, I found something she'd scrawled. Don't confuse love with filling your wounds. My biggest wound is my dad leaving, not wanting me. What would fill that for me? A man who couldn't live without me. This was a secret thought, not one I was meant to read, but it festered. Molly's need for me was not to be confused with love, and I was presumed to be helpless in her thrall, not able to live without her. I read that prayer should be short, but often repeated, and that I should always pray as if beginning for the first time. The other instructions from this old Orthodox anthology were simple. After waking, enter within yourself, stand enclosed in the heart, consider all the activity of the spiritual life, absorb yourself in a chosen part of it, and there remain. Or, still more briefly, collect yourself and make secret prayer in your heart. This from Theophan the Recluse. At one point, Molly's landlady opined that I was something of a recluse, presumably because I, in almost 20 years of living in our small community, never joined her celebrated Scrabble circle or accompanied my previous girlfriend for the equally renowned Easter egg painting. Molly, strangely impressionable, wondered why I didn't have more friends. Would I depend on her too much in a relationship? Is reclusive a pejorative, I ask? What does that mean, pejorative? Disingenuous was another word Molly didn't actually know. She could enchant that way. The first prayer in the Russian Orthodox tradition is short and simple. Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy upon me. This mantra was the bedrock of the monastery and the discipline of countless ascetics. Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me. I have tried, unsuccessfully, several times to say this prayer to myself and out loud without feeling self-conscious, and it should be done ceaselessly. The purported effects of praying ceaselessly are much like the Buddhist enlightenment I read about. Unceasing prayer overcomes evil through hope in God. It leads a man into holy simplicity, weaning his mind from its habit of diversity of thought and from devising plans about himself and his neighbors, keeping him always in scantiness and humility of thoughts. This composes his training. He who prays ceaselessly gradually loses the habit of wandering thoughts, of distraction, of being filled with vain worries. And the more deeply this training in holiness and humility enters the soul and takes root in it, the more he loses these habits of mind. Finally, he becomes as a child, as he is commanded in the gospel, and is made a fool for Christ's sake, that is, he loses the false reason of the world and receives from God a spiritual understanding. This is from Bishop Ignaty, 1807 to 1867.
What is the essence of prayer? Raising the mind and heart toward God. This answers nothing, only raising questions. How are heart and mind different? Does God exist outside the mind? What does one mean by God? The first step in learning to pray, I learned from my other book, is to free ourselves from preconceptions of what prayer is. The second step on the road to prayer is to forget any fixed ideas we may have about how to pray. I also learned from the same book that Iris Murdoch once said that prayer is the most essential of all human activities. But can we trust a fiction writer? Can we assume that prayer, even if based on false premises, is somehow efficacious? Pray as you can, not as you can't, an old adage says. I have come to a point where I can say the following poem, this delicate effusion of nostalgic longing by an anonymous British writer from the 15th century, out loud as a prayer. Western wind, when will thou blow? The small rain down can rain. Christ, that my love were in my arms, and I in my bed again. I sometimes thought that Molly was about to leave. She shifted moods rapidly, sometimes for no discernible reason. I feel this heaviness, she said 2 months into our often tempestuous relationship. We were planning a 3-day vacation for my birthday. A tightness in my chest. I don't know why. I feel I have to escape. I don't feel we should be together. She was frank, and yet she said she knew this mood would pass. We trusted ourselves to time. That particular mood, however, continued for the whole long drive up the coast to a lodge where she bought me a massage and a birthday dinner and provided sexual release without once making me feel comfortable or loved or secure. It's difficult to show and not tell this kind of detachment. It's as simple and as problematic as her hand staying limp when I took it in mine. On her providing only, or her providing only succinct one word or one sentence answers where there should have been loving, heartfelt paragraphs, it was as if someone had turned down the damper on her heart. If I felt you really loved me, I told her over the birthday dinner of salmon with a view of deer in a meadow above the sea, I would say we could get through this. This is just a mood, right? And you do love me. She nodded without meeting my eyes, and the mood continued all the way home where she left me off, saying that the timing was right to be alone. I felt then that I might not see her again, that dutiful she had fulfilled her birthday obligation. I sensed she was leaving and that there was nothing I could do. Jesus, she said in apparent frustration, we've been together for 3 days solid. You call that solid? I asked. I was awash. An abyss did open up. I had never loved anyone so much, never felt so much anxiety, never feared loss like that, never felt so lonely. The detective, whom I can't help but remembering had a mole just like Cindy Crawford, questioned me closely on this feeling and attempted to probe, not too subtly, as to how I might act on this insecurity, this anxiety. Was it, in a word, motive? I believe that I convinced the detective that I love Molly with all my heart, even my shadow side. Perhaps particularly the shadow had been enlisted in my adoration, not in obsessive, unrealistic deification, but one tempered by an appreciation of her judgmental side, her occasional hair trigger irritability, her unpredictable moments of erotic accessibility. I would wonder sometimes if she had been abused as a child, so vehement in her rejection of the physical. But at other times, she approached sex with joyful lustiness. She was like two or more different people, and over the few months I was fortunate, blessed, I can say now, to share with her, I came to believe that she was simply, marvelously, exquisitely sensitive to her own hormones, her own feelings, her own vagaries. She was a princess. No pee escaped her. One very peculiar thing about our relationship, and I even mentioned this to the detective, was that I had written a novel, queasy autobiographical, I called it, in which the love interest was a potter and a Zen student. The actual woman whom I based the character on was neither. But strangely, 5 years after finishing the novel, Molly was both. And there she was, reading the novel in manuscript, gasping occasionally at the way our life together was playing out what I had already written. I'm almost afraid to read on, she said. I'm afraid I'll spoil the surprise of my own life. Actually, I think Molly got bored with the book, with the solipsism and lack of real plot, and just put it down. It was not a page-turner, as more than one publisher has told me. In the book, the woman does indeed finally retreat from the drunken narrator in a kind of Orphic descent to a Zen monastery. She disappears, and by seeking her there, the narrator confirms the obduracy of her decision and of her absence. She had already left the monastery, anticipating his pursuit, his looking back, if you will. Not a happy ending, but echoing, rather subtly and cleverly, I thought, Orpheus's loss of Eurydice. Not one the narrator has any control over, except in the discipline of not looking back, of not requiring proof that his lover is still there behind him. I wonder sometimes if I might not have been better off writing a happy ending. Molly and I once visited Pacific Grove, where I had grown up. I took her out to breakfast at Lover's Point, overlooking Monterey Bay. "I can see why this is called Lover's Point," she said to the waitress. "It's so romantic." I explained that the whole town had started as a tent camp for Chautauqua meetings, and the real name of the place was Lovers of Christ Point. "Actually," the waitress noted, "just last week a bride was swept off those rocks by some sort of freak wave, and the groom drowned trying to save her. Talk about romantic." "I hate stories like that," Molly said. "No," said the waitress, "that's not a story, it's a true thing. I was working that morning, it was on TV. I spent several days at the goat barn, hoping for some development. Some return to normalcy. Are you here for the duration? I spent several days at the goat barn, hoping for some development, some return to normalcy. Then I spent several weeks making daily visits, but staying in my own residence, her dog Listless, my constant companion. I wondered what to do about Molly's rent, about her clothes and belongings, which were in fact minimal. I paid a visit to the landlady, who surprisingly offered me a cup of tea. "You know, there is something rather peculiar I've been wanting to mention to you," the landlady said, stirring honey into her own tea thoughtfully, a tintinnabulation of spoon against porcelain. "Many years ago, when I was still young, but certainly old enough to remember, my sister, my twin sister actually, maybe 5 or 6, walked from this very house one morning up the narrow path to what was then actually the goat barn to feed. I was always a little jealous of her, you know, how twins have to always share the limelight." "Yes," I said. "Well, she didn't come back. She just disappeared. They searched the berries and the nettles in the creek for 5 days. They brought in 2 hounds. They looked for wells and fissures and fault lines and underground caves, but they never found the slightest trace. That was 75 years ago, of course. I didn't want to tell you right away. I thought it might be too discouraging. And, of course, it would have created a brouhaha with television cameras and reporters. I didn't want you to give up hope. Oh, this house has some stories to tell." I take this new information back to the goat barn. The dog trots up the path, expectantly, hopefully, sniffing and whining. In the end, I conclude that Molly's disappearance could not have been intentional. She loved her dog too much. I pray, as I have taken to praying several times every day, for Molly's return. I weep. I recite poetry. And neither the angels in heaven above nor the demons down under the sea can ever dissever my soul from the soul of the beautiful animal Lee. I read. In my book, How to Build a Time Machine, I find we are not so firm in time or space as we have come to believe. The view that the present moment is throughout the universe the same moment is wrong, deeply and seriously wrong. It is theoretically possible, the physicist Paul Davies tells us, to escape the confines of energy, time, and matter we conceive as ordinary. He begins with fictional works by H.G. Wells, Ray Bradbury, Michael Crichton, and Carl Sagan, but moves to serious physicists. There are quantum wormholes coming and going at a frenetic pace throughout the universe, each living on borrowed energy and time, and theoretically they could act as gateways in space-time. Perhaps the goat barn is the touchdown point for some tunnel, like Dorothy's tornado, that opens at the other end in the future or the past or in a different universe entirely. Davies includes a famous dictum of J.B.S. Haldane. The universe is not only queerer than we think, it is queerer than we can think. After reading descriptions of colliders, imploders, inflators, and differentiators, the necessary components for actually building a time machine, I decide the rational approach to explaining Molly's disappearance as a naked singularity in the cosmic field of information does not offer much solace. Solace, surviving moment to moment, emerges as a primary concern. In my book, Learn to Pray, I find a prayer from Lao Tzu, the Chinese sage, born in 600 BC. Grant me the ability to be alone. May it be my custom to go outside each day, among the trees and grasses, among all growing things, and there may I be alone and enter into prayer, talk with the one that I belong to. I like the way the poem narrows, like a tornado, into the loneliness and paradoxical expansiveness of prayer. After a little over a month, as rent comes due, I decide to move Molly's belongings. I have received permission from her parents, who don't really know me, but who, despite their obvious suspicions, are content to let someone on this coast deal with Molly's meager estate. They are confident that she will return, that she has embarked on some strange California-type spiritual quest. On the second day of sorting, cleaning, and disposing, Molly's landlady suggests that I clean her stuff out of the refrigerator and freezer as well. In the freezer, I find a small black book, Molly's journal. She kept it there, her landlady explains, because she'd read that, in case of fire, items stored in freezers often survive. I am ashamed to say that I did not hesitate in opening the book and reading without stopping from beginning to end. The pages were cold, almost icy to the touch. I discovered that Molly had actually, within our first month together, had an affair with another man, a shaman from one of the Plains tribes. He happened to be participating in a workshop retreat she had attended very early in our relationship. I remembered that she had mentioned seeing an old acquaintance and rekindling some of the old passion. A little high school necking went on, she confessed then, but I explained that I had a new man in my life and that was that. Besides, I was following a sacred path. The whole workshop was on sex as an addiction. This part of the journal reads more like a juicy, quivering white thigh novel, my name not mentioned once, and the shaman apparently backing off before Molly had a chance, leaving her in tears and feeling abandoned. Oh, to be a red Indian, instantly prepared, and astride one galloping mount, leading into the wind, to skim with each fleeting quivering touch over the quivering ground, till one shed the spurs, or there were no spurs, till one flung off the reins, for there were no reins, and could barely see the land unfurl as a smooth-shorn heath before one, now that horse's neck and horse's head were gone. Here, Molly was quoting Kafka from a book I had loaned her for that workshop trip, the book I had recently taken up again, a book from which I can apparently not escape. On her return, I was the default node. She confessed immediately, but she did not confess thoroughly. Energy denied is more interesting than energy available. And she continued to daydream and dream about this soulmate throughout our 6 months together. I was unfavorably compared with his imagined perfection several times in the record, and those instances coincided with times in our relationship when I'd noticed her suddenly absent or annoyed, irritable for no apparent reason. She wrote of the empty look in my eyes versus the bright energy of his exuberance and spirituality, my lack of wit and repartee juxtaposed on the fantasy of his extroverted ease. As a shaman, he had spiritual relations worldwide. I was recluse, boring, and slow, with no friends, no fun, really, not spiritual. Only weeks before her disappearance, Molly wondered if I was the right man for her. She wrote that she was bored with me, bored with the whole thing, and that my clinging and yearning after sex disgusted her. These were perhaps things I should never have read, dark thoughts that were meant for the confines of her journal, thoughts once expressed, dispelled. With an act of will, I could convince myself that none of this would have surfaced and that there was no need to be hurt or jealous. There was another whole area she never trusted me enough to mention. Her involvement with a spiritual group utilizing ayahuasca, the magic intoxicant from the Amazon basin, which, according to a book in Molly's library, the Indians believe can free the soul from corporal confinement, allowing it to wander free and return to the body at will. The soul, thus untrammeled, liberates its owner from the realities of everyday life and introduces him to wondrous realms of what he considers reality and permits him to communicate with his ancestors. The drink is actually a brew of hallucinogenic bark from jungle vines, ferns, tobaccos, mints, cacti, and sedges. Different kinds of ayahuasca result as the ingredients are manipulated. The drink is said to promote telepathic powers. Shamans may fly about in the form of a bird or travel in supernatural canoes manned by demons. She wrote in her journal that I did not have enough balance emotionally, psychologically, or spiritually to have the proper relationship with the spirit of ayahuasca. I would be afraid to tell him of my involvement or my commitments at this point. I don't know if our relationship could bear the strain, and yet I feel it adds to the tensions between us, this secret. Well, duh, I say. Here I was in a half-baked Castaneda book without a clue as to what was going on. Well, I did have an inkling. I thought we would come to that eventually. On one of the pages of her journal near the end, she has painted what the Huichols called Nerica, apparently as part of one of her spiritual retreats. Nerikas are portals between so-called ordinary and non-ordinary realities, both passageway and barrier between worlds, both mirror and the actual face of divinity. The painting in her journal is a simple square with a cross in the middle, each arm ending in a circle, rather like a Parcheesi game. They represent the four cardinal directions. The reds of the background are intense, a field of fire. Molly's journal ends on an awkward note. She writes, I am not sure how much longer I can endure this. I am living a lie here, living with Paul, and I don't know how to bring truth to it. He has involved himself in so many aspects of my life. I don't see a way to pull the plug without devastating him. I am worried that he will drink again. Of course, this is not my problem. He follows me from room to room, from house to house. He drives me crazy. I stumble from the long session with Molly's journal. I make my way away from the house and into town. I am bored by him, by the whole thing. I am living a lie. She wrote these things, and that means that at some point she felt them enough to write them down. This gives them a power. He drives me crazy. I find myself with a cup of coffee and a paper cup, browsing in the self-help section of the bookstore. A year ago, I would not have ventured here. The books seem such frontal, brazen, graceless endeavor. Knowing what you want and getting it. Too many exclamation points, too much positive thinking. Yet now, I am pleased to find a book that promised miracles if you simply write things down. Find the perfect mate, buy your dream house, get a great new job. Write it down, make it happen. You don't even have to pray. Just the act of writing will energize the universe around your wishes. Our lives are narrative. We have a hand in writing. Aren't I living proof? Don't I know it? Of course, this is not true. You can't look experience, even the experience of the irrational depths, directly in the face with this kind of impatience, with this craving after something. This is an illusion, a delusion of control. It will slip away. I feel as if I am backing out of a small space on my hands and knees. I have given up prayer. I have given up writing as any sort of pragmatic endeavor. I am not patient or impatient. In a book on the Buddhist precepts, at the fringes of the self-help table, I find yet another quotation from Kafka. There is no need for you to leave the house. Stay at your table and listen. Don't even listen. Just wait. Don't even wait. Be completely quiet and alone. The world will offer itself to you to be unmasked. It can't do otherwise. In raptures, it will writhe before you. I buy more books. I dwell in possibility. I still long for the courage to feel some benign, positive attitude toward the moment, to have the anxiety lift. I would like one last time to lie with Molly, kiss her again, put my arms around her and draw her down to me so I could feel her breaths all perfumed. perfume, yes, and her heart going like mad, and yes, I would like to hear her say, yes, I will, yes. It is not true I have given up prayers. I find myself without intention in the dark, quiet moments, praying for Molly's return, for clarity, for peace, and for patience. I find in one of Molly's books about Gauguin, now incorporated into my own library, that in 1897, just after finishing a painting called Nevermore, you can see the raven in the window behind the golden nude, and a sense of menace pervades the flat canvas. He received a letter informing him of his daughter's death. I have lost a daughter. I do not love God anymore, he wrote. The painting on Molly's boutique was painted just after and was meant to be comparable with the Gospels, an interpretation of a great mystery. Having completed the painting, Gauguin, destitute, retreated to the wilds of Tahiti and took arsenic in an unsuccessful suicide attempt. He vomited up the arsenic, walked back to town, and recuperating, painted the white horse, a vision of paradise, of harmony between man and nature, or recaptured innocence. In the meantime, his dealer sold Where Do We Come From? What Are We? Where Are We Going? For 1,000 francs. Shortly after, late enough to constitute a happy ending, an art dealer guaranteed Gauguin enough money to free him from financial worries for the rest of his life. I will, for the time being, leave it at that. A happy ending.